Hi, I'm Tony Riddle, and this is the Nat Life Pod, a platform for conversation to help close the gap between wellness as an industry and wellness as a state of being. Big shout out to this episode's sponsor, XL Coffee. XL are renowned organic coffee producers here in the UK who have gone to extraordinary lengths to ensure their coffee is mold-free and has kept its antioxidant potency. XL are waking up the world of coffee. I'm a big fan and recommend you go give them a try. Use discount code NatLifePod at checkout. Details are in the show notes. On this week's episode, I'm talking to Tom Johnson. Tom is super inspiring. He's an ex-England international rugby player with an incredible backstory. We unpack a lot here, how he found himself in rugby, how he built the man who he is today through that process, what he describes as an institution and the original institution that led to that, which was boarding school. Tom was bullied on the daily for a long period of time. That has led, obviously, to building the incredible rugby player that he was, but has led to something really quite profound that is going to reach the masses and going to change the lives of many. I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I did. Tom Johnson in the house. Welcome to California. It feels like California,
I know.
Don't it?
It's an unbelievable month, isn't it? It makes you really, really appreciate like the Southwest.
Yeah.
I just love it. But then coming from Exeter, it's like this is the gateway to heaven with coming down here. It's like just amazing. We spend all the time down here with the family. So
yeah, it's a short trip, right?
Yes, hour and a half. We go North Cornwall, Treana, and actually go off peak, so we go October time when the sort of tourists are gone. We just love it. It's the coastline, it's that water as well. It's magical.
It's a very different place in the school holidays.
It is, but having two youngsters, I appreciate the pain and agony from both sides.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like it's pain in the squat some holidays, but it also gives the kids so much joy, you know. And it's like, well, we're going to go through that pain of the tourists and chalk roads and everything like that because we know how good it is for the kids.
My best memories are from Cornwall. Camping. Mm. So my parents used to bring us every year. I mean, we come from a big family, so the whole family would come. And my mum's one of eight, so I mean, all the cousins, everyone, all be on the beach. I remember beach fires, jacket potatoes in the fire, all of that. Just some of the best memories. And camping, not in houses, just camping. And now to think that we're living here. And it was being on that last Southwest Coastal Path, that attempt at the Southwest Coastal Path. It was getting into Cornwall that we've got to get back down here. We've got to reignite this thing because we were thinking of moving here.
Yeah.
And it's just breathtaking. It is quite extraordinary that we have this on our doorstep.
But it's interesting. So we've been coming here for 40 years as a family, like exactly the same with my parents.
Mm.
And what we'll probably get onto is those early childhood experiences, they stay with you for the rest of your life. And it's no surprise that you're back here, that I'm back here, because actually this is where we spent our childhood and we've got great memories.
Yeah.
That's phenomenal.
Well, there's the good, the bad and the ugly from those memories as well, right?
Yeah. You carry everything.
And some of it sticks. It's great to have you back in this room. The last time we were in here, it was a deep one, right? Man-men experience. I think we clocked up a 6-hour sharing circle on that first one. It was the longest sharing circle we've had. Quite extraordinary. I remember all the fidgeting in the room, right? We were all busting, right, to get to the toilet, but we were so immersed. It's like, we can't stop them from talking now.
It was like a bit of a test, wasn't it? It's like, who's going to break first? Then someone went, it's like, I can't do any longer.
I was sitting there thinking, I've got the 48-year-old bladder here.
It was, it's like, you know, it's funny. It's like, the ironic thing is we're all there to be like really be open and be honest, and everyone's sitting there going, I don't want to break. It's like break, and then everyone went as soon as one person went. It's like everyone went because
and then the honesty came out. We were all busting.
Exactly. So no, it was like I come from quite a almost quite institutionalized background. So for me, coming here was a big step, and that those 6 hours and this time in this room was a massive eye-opener for me of what I've been missing, and then being able to feel truly truly connected to be able to open up and not be afraid of the judgment particularly. And that was, we had some, I had some really deep personal experiences from that weekend. Mm-hmm. But things that I've also taken away with me and just been able to enact into that, just simple things like being able to sit like this, never been able to sit like this all through my previous career, never been able to sit like cross-legged for any amount of time without being in absolute agony. And I now do on a daily basis, and having liver and having good, like being outside in the morning with my matcha tea, and those little things daily make a big difference to me. I know it, but it's those little things daily that make a big difference to me. And it's that routine, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to go into that institution for those that aren't aware of Tom Johnson. There'll be a lot of people that are. Kieran was immediately aware of who Tom Johnson was. Many of us in the room weren't aware who Tom Johnson was and what the career was, or the career path that was chosen.
Yeah.
So for the people who aren't aware of Tom Johnson, should we start with rugby?
Seems a good, yeah, I think it's a good spot, is sort of what probably best known for being. So I was very lucky to play professional rugby, managed to play 8 times for my country between 2012, 2015, which was like unbelievable and something that it was never a career path that is very untrodden career path, because I wasn't into academy when you're sort of 14. Wasn't like one of those high achievers going, like you look at say like Jack Noel or Henry Slade, who are world-class athletes. They were recognized at the age of 9, you know, went through that system.
Talents immediately there, recognized, like
straight into the academies, and that's the majority, that's the most trodden path. Whereas mine, I finished university at like 23, and then got a contract at Coventry, and then played rugby. I was like, go and give this a crack for a year. And then it sort of like went on. This is good. I really enjoyed it. And then did that for a couple of years, and then came down to Exeter, and then spent the rest of my career at Exeter. And we went from, you know, Division One team, Championship team, up to Premiership champions in the space of 10 years.
Wow.
And was part of that journey all the way through, and got capped for England that time, touring South Africa, Argentina, New Zealand. It was unbelievable.
Was that your first test then against, was that South Africa?
Yeah, yeah. South Africa. So, and that was off the back of, so we got promoted 2010, 2012. I was like, so playing Plymouth, traveling around the country, playing all these grounds. And then 2 years later, I'm lining up in Durban, Johannesburg, for the three test series. And it's just like, this is mental.
And that's quite some acceleration. So what was going on mentally in that period of time?
I think the big thing was getting out of the championship. So I thought, from a club perspective, we were like, right, can we get out? Can we get into the Premiership? You know, that's the hallowed ground. Can we get into the top flight playing rugby? That's what you're trying to do. Mm. You're trying to play against the best. And we're very lucky in the first sense that they changed the structure of the league the season before, and it came down to a playoff, whereas before it was always the top team got promoted, and you got promoted based on how many points you accumulated, not the top two playing each other on a two game, whoever comes out on aggregate score gets promoted. So Bristol were ahead of us in terms of the league position, but then we beat them over the course of 2 legs. Where normally that was the first time that format had been trialed. So we were like, right, see you later. We went into the Premiership. And then the mental shift was the fact that actually playing the brand of rugby that we were playing in the Championship was going to get us relegated in the Premiership. You know, we had to really rethink how we wanted to play rugby and how we wanted to be perceived as a team. Mm. And to be fair, the coaches did very well of going, yeah, we rocked up first day of pre-season, going into a Premiership season, and we didn't do any of the training drills that we'd done the previous 2 or 3 years with Exeter. Everything was about throwing the ball around, attacking, playing with pace. It's very different league structures and how the game's won. And we're like, well, we're going to go out. Look, everyone's got us down to be relegated. There's nothing better than playing with a chip on your shoulder from an internal motivation point of view. So if someone goes,
this team's crap, we're going to beat them. You're like, well, I'm going to show you that we're not. And so you train harder, you play harder, and you really, because we got much more, we got a huge amount to lose. You know, we got from a financial point of view, it's like there's a big difference between Championship rugby and Premiership rugby. Mm. You got people with mortgages, looking after their families. Like, this needs to work, not just from a success point of view of
there's
how
a
we
hunger
feel.
There, right?
There's a need. Mm. And then we finished. I think we finished 8 out of 12, and we were safe by Christmas because we'd put in so much work and we'd done it the right way by playing fun, attractive rugby. And everyone's like, this is like, it was a breath of fresh air.
Mm. I guess what was shared in here, what felt like at the time, the story, I kind of aligned it in my thoughts of like the David Goggins, you know, there was a backstory, a driving force of this career of his, let's say now, that was underpinned perhaps by trauma, but what we've kind of discussed pre-Mike's getting out,
yeah,
it's almost like, well, actually, that's there and it has formed where you are today, but the trauma surfacing isn't necessarily off the back of losing identity in rugby or anything like that. It comes into what's the first institution, I guess, you went in pre-rugby, right?
Yeah.
You know? And that was an incredible sharing, because again, here you were with this amazing career in rugby, a big dude in the room, strong, confident, and yet there was this huge backstory that I think was the first time you shared that, right?
Yeah. My wife, getting here was a really interesting story in itself, that I had no idea about this or what I needed to do. I just knew I was lost. I knew like a year, I'd probably been lost for quite a long time. And I just knowing that I wasn't, someone wasn't right, but not knowing how to address it or to take action. And, you know, from my coming out of rugby, I'm gone into personal coaching and lifestyle coaching and trying to, and my big mantra in life is to take action, is to go, right, well, let's do something about it. You know, are you moving well? No, right, let's do something about it. Let's get moving more regularly. Let's change nutrition. Let's change sleeping habits. Let's look at how we can make the best of what we've got. Not, I've got a bad knee, I'm just going to not do anything. That's not how I work. That's not what the science says or anything. But that's what a lot of people do. So I wanted to take action. I knew I needed to, but I didn't know how to. And my wife actually booked me in on the man weekend, and she's like, "I booked you in on this thing. You go." And I was like, "Good. I need to go." So I needed someone to help me take that action, and then came down here. And
that's a great partnership, by the way.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it's very much there.
It resonates.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Rather than trying to fix you in a way, seeing that actually there's the need there.
Mm. It was one of those ones where it's just any action is better than no action.
Mm.
And I didn't know. And I thought this, so I was like, come down. I was like, the great thing is I'm going to just be myself. I'm going to be in a room full of men that haven't met me before. I can say what I've been trying to tell people for a long time. You know, for a long time, I've been this rugby player that's had to trot out the rugby stuff of going, yeah, we're a great team, you know, doing corporate and all this stuff, telling people basically what they want to hear about how good the club is and how hard we train. And actually just being able to go, actually, things are pretty bad. I'm in a bit of a bad state at the moment. I didn't know if it was going to work coming down here. But in my head, I was in a really good place in terms of going, well, I'm just going to take that step and see what happens. And then it was the best thing I did.
Yeah, what I really admired in that circle, and also talking to you afterwards, was, and hearing you discussing with Kieran, it was like, I don't actually want to talk about rugby.
Mm.
You know, it was parking the whole rugby career in that moment.
Yeah.
Because again, what you've been faced by that corporate world, it's a mask that you wear, and it's not your true identity within that, right?
No.
Who Tom is in that moment. But in the circle, we certainly got to see that, right?
Yeah, it's definitely not. I don't think rugby is my identity. And and it's been good for me, and I love the game, but I don't love the game anymore. It's had a massive impact on me. And I think that there's an awful lot more to life than rugby, and that's what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
You know, I'm interested in enjoying different aspects, enjoying different sports, enjoying companies of different people, because what you're institutionalized into thinking from rugby is, and this myth of normal, just generally, and it's not necessarily to do with rugby, but just generally, if you step outside the realms of what people perceive as normal, you get classed as sort of an outsider or a different thinker. And that's what I'm really interested in now. It's actually looking at, there's that book, isn't there, that The Myth of Normal by Gabor Maté. Yeah. And it is all about breaking down, just because we've built things in to be normal. Like having a, you know, if you go to the pub and have a beer, or you go to the pub and you don't have a beer, it's sort of frowned on, going, what's going on? Why aren't you having a beer in the pub? So I'm quite happy with socializing and having a soda water or whatever. But it's that pressure that everyone's puts on you to be able to conform to their type of normal.
Yeah, it's the normalizing behaviors, and again, they can be good or bad, right? And I think the beauty of the path that we're traversing right now is stepping outside of that. The limiting beliefs or those behaviors that, yeah, can be considered, well, actually, they are socially normal, but let's be realistic, they're not natural, and they're not enabling me to reach my potential, you know, truly. If anything, I think I've been in those realms with the alcohol, and again, it does create something. It creates a space where people can start communicating, but it's the stripping back of, I guess it's the inhibitions, they're losing their inhibitions in that process, right? It's again a shame that we need alcohol, we need that kind of circle, when we can actually, as we created an amazing space, and that you're actually going to remember the conversations the next day that have been had, you know?
And also, you know that, you know, you talk about the alcohol talk, and you know, generally people, we've had, you know, it's been great for, going back to the rugby, it's been great for like team bonding, because you generally get to know your team really well from it. But, It's a shame that people think that you need to have that to enable the conversation to happen. And what we created here is actually being able to take, not just talk about things, but then be able to go and action things based off sound judgment. Whereas, you know, when you're hungover and stuff like that, and you had those alcohol driven sort of conversations, you're always questioning and going, was that the alcohol? What do I really think? And then you end up feeling more depressed and go down that spiral the next day, being hungover and not really knowing, having any clear direction. The beauty with being here was there's such clarity of thought. There's such a, this feels good. This is me at my best. This is what I need to do.
I held a circle at the weekend at the 100 Human Experience. We had a women's circle and a men's circle, and then the idea would, we'd come together in celebration afterwards.
Yeah.
And I started it, there's 42 guys in a circle. I was already smashed at this point. So,
yeah.
And the beauty of the circle, it was recognized that Tony's a bit tired right now. Kieran stepped in and said, do you know, can I open it? I'll do some breath with everyone. And then Chris, who was there, closed it. But in between that, Kieran and Chris, I worked with a guy called Ben Yeager. Mm-hmm. Ben Yeager is a conflicts coach. So he was a Israeli soldier.
Yeah.
And he'd only ever had one side of the story, right? Again, which is this, what his programming is, his templates are, and finds himself at the age of 21 doing national service there in the back of a patrol wagon with an assault rifle, and big dude, a bit like yourself, and sitting in the back of this patrol wagon. His sergeant opens up the back of the wagon and throws in this 65-year-old Palestinian man with a sack over his head who messed his pants, shaking. And the sergeant says, if he moves, shoot him. Right? Ben has this lightning moment, this huge awakening in that process. And just, oh my God, what am I doing? And serves his time. And then out of that becomes a conflicts coach and brings war-torn areas together, and specifically men.
Yeah.
And he starts with an opening, and then he has a deck of cards with, it could be, I don't know, mum, dad, any relationship or something that's significant in their lives, let's say, and then they unpack a vulnerable moment or trauma or anything. So the idea is you're paired up. So you're in your pair and you shuffle the cards and you hand it to the partner and the partner takes the card and then they start sharing. And what happens in that moment is they recognize how much they actually have in common. All right, amazing. And then they have this kind of five rhythms dance afterwards.
Yeah.
So again, that brings something quite unique in. There's no alcohol involved in the dance. There's just men dancing, right? So on this particular one, I had the unhealthy masculine traits that I'd put on the cards and I paired them up. So I had like 21 groups and shuffling the cards. And it was, I think, an hour and a half of talking, like full on. There weren't any breaks, but it was being given permission, but actually breaking something down by giving something in the hands, almost like a talking cushion again. Bit like being handed a pint, I guess, you know, but around a fire. And the opening and the sharing was really quite something again, you know?
Definitely.
Yeah, mate. It's just deep and powerful. And I think there's so much in that. And and again, how much we all have in common when we start, you know? See, Kieran, when he discusses rugby, because going back into when he started, and he had a chip on his shoulder in the origins of that, because most of the guys were public school boys and he wasn't.
Yeah.
And yet you were a public school boy. And so that was part of what the other institution, I guess, that you were going through or went through.
Yeah.
So do you want to discuss some of that, the time, what you experienced and what that led to, perhaps?
I think one of my abilities when I was like playing rugby was all about my ability to train hard and be something, like, you know, be this as big and as strong and as quick and as powerful as I could possibly be. And everyone puts that down to me just trying to be the best I could be, you know, being given an opportunity, right? I know if I'm as big and as strong as I can be, I'm going to have a better impact on the game of rugby and achieve the heights that I achieved. And what we spoke about when we came down here was actually the reasons why I've got that drive. And it came down to suffering like severe childhood trauma.
Yeah.
When I was at this public school. And from the ages of sort of 13 to 18, like being systematically bullied for, you know, for the first 2 years, it was physical bully. And then that sort of calmed down. And then the psychological bullying was the reason that I am who I am today, as in I had to build myself from having the physical bullying and the things that sort of went on, and you don't realize it. I didn't realize it until maybe 5 years ago when I became a coach and I understood the importance of sleep, the importance of feeling grounded and feeling emotionally stable to be able to go and actually excel and actually to be able to learn. And at school, we're there to learn, you know? But when I was like 12 and a half, 13, I'd go weeks of having water poured on me at night. So we're in a sort of open dorm, and there's two bullies in my year. And I was in a five year. There's five of us in a year group in this one boarding house. So it was like so intense. It was like these are the five people that hung around the whole time, and two of them were like two of the worst people I've ever met. And from the, you know, a 13 year old boy being able to do that to someone else was pretty hard to take. So I went through weeks and months in that first year of just having buckets of water poured on me, and I didn't know what it was. I didn't know.
And this is at night when you're in bed.
At night. So, you know, I'd sleep three nights out of a week. I'd be just sleeping soaking wet.
And also, you know, just to unpack, I mean, firstly, just entering boarding school from being at home, right? That away from mum and dad, that experience.
I think the thing with me is I had a really good childhood.
Yeah.
Like from the age of 0 to 12, I was down here in Cornwall. You know, I was running around playing football. There's such happy memories and pictures in my head. And that's those pictures are in my head, and those are the pictures I've kept at home.
So they're the real deep foundations of
deep
Tom,
foundation,
right?
The deep foundations, and my the role model in that in those early informative years. And I think this is one of the reasons why I want to share the story, is because I think I'm not, there's no way I'm fixed or know exactly how I'm going to sort of fix myself from it. But being able to talk about it is sort of half the problem. And letting people realize that what children experience at such a young age has a huge impact on where they get to later on in life in terms
and how they
get there. And that it's also, it's not like a, there's not like a rule book on it. It's not like if you suffer trauma, this is going to hit you when you're 22, when you're 35. I'm going to turn 41 in about a month's time, and I'm still unpacking it. It probably hit me when I was 36 years old. And then, but actually it hit me a lot earlier. It's actually hit me constantly through my life, because I now realize that every time I was training, it hit me, because actually that's why I was training, not because of trying to reach the top. It was because I didn't want the bullies to get me.
Well, you're building this physical...
But that's it. And that's what we spoke about.
Armor,
building this armor to protect, this protects. And it came when I was, those early years when I was like from the age of four, my role model was my granddad. And he was absolute fat, like just the best. He was old school. He'd been in the war. He was an Air Vice Marshal in the RAF. So he was a proper disciplinarian. But he was... Every time we went there to his house, he'd be doing chin-ups, he'd be doing press-ups, he'd be doing sit-ups. He could break an apple with his bare hands in half. It'd just like rotate like three or four times and just crack open. He was having cold baths at the age of like 84. Mm. Now, when we went around there, and he's like, this is back in the 90s, and he's having cold baths. Like, Grandad, what the hell are you doing, you crazy old...
Sorry, how old was he then?
He was 84.
There you go.
Like, honestly, and he was just the strongest. He was... He was eating fruit and nuts and meat, and he got these boots with these little hooks on them, and he'd be hanging upside down, doing upside down sit-ups off a bar. Most people can't do a pull-up off, and it's just like, and he'd be running 5 miles a day.
So he's kind of your then physical elder in a way.
Yeah, but when we went around, I've got two other brothers. So it's like, right, some holidays we'd be like round at granddad's house. And he'd be like, right, fellas, let's get into the garage. Because he knew we had, we're young guys, we've got so much energy, he's gonna want to tire us out so we can sleep. to entertain us, to make sure. And there's also just part of a bit of a discipline about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really interesting so I had great memories of that. But then when the bullying started, it wasn't just like having water chucked on me every night. It was like when I sat in a room and they walked into the room, they'd sit behind me and kick my chair whilst watching telly, just constant kicking the chair. And then they'd sit on me and things called noogies. Don't know if you've ever had a noogie, but basically when someone basically skull smashes you, so sit on your lap and just sit there and just pummel it, like smash you on the top of the head. And they'd do that, and I'd be like, so it was mental. So I was in a constant flux of going, I'd come into a room, my anxiety would go up, obviously,
because in that state of when's this coming next, when's this coming
100%
next?
It's like waiting next? For it. It wasn't like if it was when.
Yeah.
And the problem with that, I actually got into there's a bit of the Stockholm syndrome, where you actually get closer to the people that are causing you the trauma, because you almost want to satisfy them, to work out, going, well, hang on, what have I done? How do I make this right?
How do I fix it?
But they used to, so my school day would be like my school day would be completely hinged on whether they'd beat me up, throw me water, abuse me in any way or whatever. And if they hadn't, I'd be like, what a good day. And if they had, it was a bad day. So I was constantly on this roller coaster of emotions every school day. And that's like walking into a room going, well, I hope they're not in there. Like feeling anxious, walking into a room, hoping someone's not in there at the age of 13. It's like, I look back and I go, that is mental. And then we're in that day and age, and we're still in that day and age where people don't talk about it. Older boys see it and they go, oh, they're just having a bit of, it's just a little bit, it's not too bad, they'll get over it sort of thing. And then teachers turning blind eyes and that kind of stuff. And I look back and I'm like, I feel quite let down by it all. But then so after 2 years or a year and a half of that, I started to grow a little bit. And bearing in mind, my birthday's in July and these guys are September birthdays.
Mm.
They're nearly a full year, chronological year older than me. So it's a big difference. At the age of like 13, it's just over 10%. They're just under 10% more developed than me.
Well, not just that, more developed mentally as well. So yeah. They're fully aware, right?
100%. So I'm like this. I'm basically the run to that year.
Yeah.
And that's how I felt. And then you've got, for some reason, I know now, I started training. So after a year and a half, this was like, well, I'm going to do something about this. And I got every evening I started doing press ups.
And you've got granddad's templates at this stage, right?
And it's like, why did I do that? Because that's what I did when I was 4 years old till the age of 10. Mm. And like I said, had the best time in those years. And I went to the junior school of that secondary school. And I loved it. I was playing sport the whole time. I was a very happy child, and then came into this school on the back of a sports scholarship. So it wasn't rugby. I was cricket, hockey, athletics. I was just generally quite good at those sports, and like a bit of a jack of all trades. I could play all of them to a decent standard, and then so I came into the senior school on the back of like a sports scholarship. And within a year and a half, I was in the B teams for everything. I was like, that's not right. Like from going from up here. And it wasn't because there was an influx of amazing sports people that I suddenly realized I was way down the pecking order. It's because I was so unhappy. I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't learning. So all my reports were like, just can't concentrate in class. And I was like, well, I must be pretty thick. Being told you're pretty thick. Then finding out I got dyslexia and those kind of things. Like, oh, Tom's just not... He's not there mentally he hasn't got the capacity to learn. And I look back, I'm like, no wonder I've got the capacity to learn. I've got sleep deprivation. I'm anxious going into every class, into every room because...
Well,
I'm
you've suffered from emotional trauma, torture, let's call it, because it's physical, emotional torture, right?
And then, so then I got myself, GCSE year... I got myself much bigger and I didn't get touched and I didn't get set on. I could defend myself. Suddenly they were like, well, actually Tom's got a bit more of a bite than he used to have. It's not worth going into that.
Mm.
And you also you start to catch up physically. You're starting to, bear in mind, they're already a year ahead and things are starting to plateau. I'm like, I'm getting through this. Came back after the GCSE year. And I've grown a huge amount during that summer, and I've got like not girlfriends but friends of girls that wouldn't normally talk to me because they'd have been, say, with the bullies or known that I've been bullied. I haven't got the confidence to talk. I haven't got that ability to talk.
Well, also don't want to be associated with the one that's exactly. Being bullied.
Yeah. And there's some really interesting stats on bullying out there, but it's a much bigger issue than what people give it credit for. It's trauma, and it was chronic trauma over a long period of time, and people can suffer acute trauma and that chronic trauma. And it's the same with abuse, physical or mental abuse. It's not always associated with some, what most people call childhood. If someone been abused at childhood, they normally think it's some sort of father figure or it's some abuse that there's no way out of.
Well, I think even as an adult sitting here thinking every night you go to bed, someone comes in, pours water on you.
Mm.
Next night, someone comes in, pours water on you. You know, you're lying there in a fetal position, shivering.
Yeah.
Every night. That is a form of torture, you know?
Yeah. But
there has to be a repercussion of that.
But even in my head, I'm like... Even in my head, it's, I can see it, but I can't quite accept it.
Yeah.
So anyway, off the back of like GCSEs, and feeling confident, feeling like right, I've got this. Once the physical bullying starts, the psychological bullying starts, and actually that's when things get worse.
Yeah.
It's like, right, how are we going to it almost feels like felt. So I sat around with some of the same girls having a chat, going like, and girls wanting to sit with me, and just because I don't know about Tom. I haven't spoken to Tom since he's been at school, because he hasn't really spoken. He's always just been off trying to play sport.
Mm.
And you're at 15, 16 years old, and you're starting to get interested in girls. And one of the bullies labeled me the Rash. He started calling me the Rash because he thought I was hanging out with girls. Well, that's how it was perceived to him, rather than people wanting to be with me. So it was all me trying to hang out with other people. So he said, oh, you're like a Rash, you stop hanging around people and all this kind of stuff. And that name stuck. And then I was called, basically, it's like I completely shattered my life. Like, yeah. worse than the physical bullying. Because
so it's once you've now got the physical vessel of Tom, it's yeah. now big enough not to be bullied physically. We're now moving on to the
mental side.
Yeah.
And absolutely crushed my foundations, everything. I, and there's no way out of that. It's like I'm sat there talking with a group of people, and they're like, why are you hanging out with the Rash? They get up and leave. And like, my self-worth, I'm just like, that. Pete, it's me. The problem's me. And I've never spoken about that part. We didn't speak about that in the Man Men weekend, mm-hmm. but that Man weekend has definitely enabled me to move into, you know, it's all about unpacking, as we've learned, and I need to unpack this side of the thing.
And keep unpacking it.
And it's, you know, suddenly being able to feel at a moment's notice, like the lowest, if someone comes in and goes, they'd answer my name. So we'd do a roll call, be like James Gegg, George Walker, Joe Lane, the Rash. And you have to say yes to everything, you know? You go, yeah, here, the Rash. And everyone laugh and giggle. I was like, yeah, here. That's like, fuck me, it brings me to tears now. And it was that emotional, those two words would absolutely end my experience of that day or whatever. And it was like the teachers used to call it me. So they just, it used to start to come in to go, well, that was just my name. And the deep root hatred I have for how it came about is one of the reasons why I've never been back to that school since I left that school. Bearing in mind, I went and played for England 8 times. They hung a shirt up there going, this is a student of ours. We're really proud of him. And then got invited back to all these events. So I've never been back there because I can't face it. Because it reminds me of that work. I could have got over the physical side of things. And I did get over the physical side of things. But it was that psychological labeling that really broke me, and actually broken me since.
I think it's a really important conversation for parents to listen to in the times we're in now.
Mm.
Because imagine you had mobile phones at that stage with the camera on at this stage and the social media platforms and where bullying can go today, that's outside the physical sense of bullying.
Mm.
It seems to be normalized now within being able to capture short videos and then that being passed around, and that's again on that emotional 100%. Tier of bullying, right?
The bullying, the online bullying that's going on at the moment, I'm doing a fair bit of work in schools at the moment, and actually it's probably the reason everyone asks what your why is, it's because
I was about to say
it's
that.
Because,
yeah.
It's because actually I want to be able to, I'm trying to create a platform for children to be able to say how they are and for someone to listen, because I had no one to talk to. I couldn't talk to my parents about it. You know, from my parents' side, I sat down with my dad about 15 years ago, and he was in an absolute flood of tears. He's like, why can you tell me this?
Yeah, what stopped you? What stopped you from speaking to your parents or speaking
as embarrassed?
Yeah, was there how am I letting this happen to me?
There's a whole number of reasons. It's like the threat of actually going, having to go back in there, being a grass. Do you know that whole perceived grass?
Yeah, yeah.
Snitches get stitches.
Yeah, that was
right.
That's a theme back then, right?
That's a mantra that's still around today. Mm. There's not been able to, like, man up, Tom. You know, you've got to look after yourself. This is all in my head. the embarrassment, I was so embarrassed. I'd be so embarrassed because I could walk into, like a lunch, the lunch hall or so, the food hall or whatever. And I had to go and be specific who I had to sit next to. So I didn't, so I'd reduce the chance of being called the rash. Like the thoughts, the thought process I had to go to.
Everything having to be calculated in that way.
Every minute of every day going, right, am I increasing my chances of being called the rash or am I decreasing it? It's like, so I just went completely insular with, and the funny thing was I actually, my schoolwork suffered so badly because I always thought, you know, I always thought I was thick, I wasn't capable of anything. And then I used to titter around at class. So I'd try and make a joke of things to be the person that, oh, he's a bit of a joker, but he's all right sort of thing. And then I'm sat here now having started my own business and gone to achieve what I've done. I'm like, I can't actually have been that thick. And it's taken me 20 years to realize that. And I think it's hugely sad. I also feel like I've missed out a huge amount of my childhood and my potential. I feel like my potential is only starting to get realized now. And it's definitely changed me from having a growth mindset into thinking rather than like rugby's finished, let's just see out your days. It's right, what else can I do? How it's given me so much drive and motivation to just get going with things.
Have you managed to find kind of the language within of, you know, flipping one's perception from happened to me to happened for me? Is there any of that or is it?
Definitely. And also realizing, so I got a letter. So I went and went, whether I played international rugby or not, I don't know if I'd have got the letter, but I got a letter from, or an email from, so the bully's name was James Gegg. He's the main proprietor. And the second guy was like George Walker. And that's the first time I've spoken about these people that no one knows about who they are and don't really care. The main person emailed me and just said, I'm so sorry of how I treated you at school. I can't believe I did it and I'm really sorry. And so...
Were you able to receive that?
I think that, no, and I never replied to it.
No.
But it's also given me... It's given me a bit of closure in the sense going, right, it was that bad. Do you know, for someone to actually write, someone to find me, write into me to say, I'm sorry for how I treated you. If it had been like a normal frolicking around or mucking around, they wouldn't have gone to that trouble. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of effort that has to go into writing an email like that. And for me, that gave me a really good closure. And that was 10, 12 years ago. And I'm still trying to sort of unpack it now. So it's not like I got the letter and it was all a weight off my mind. It's like, okay, that's given me almost like a bit of a launch pad to start talking about it, but it's taken a while to get going with it.
Yeah, I always wonder from the position of the bully, because some of my behaviours when I was younger and the things I used to get up to, I remember a friend, we were starting to move into the more ceremony, spiritual work, let's say, sitting in circles. And he said, it's when it hits you of the utter disgust of your behavior. You know, you get hit with it at some stage, the guilt and shame or disgust in some of it that's come up for me in previous behaviors and stuff I've done. And then the healing can start because that has to come up. So there's always, even from their position, what they must be sitting in and feeling, because you can't park that.
No.
They're being the sheer knowing, real knowing of that, you know.
Definitely. And the same with me, it's made me question like how I treated people myself. But then these guys were 12, 13 years old, and I said sort of similar age. And you wonder how much, and this is where I'm very interested in terms of like the childhood experiences that we go through, because if I sit back and take off my emotional hat and I go, right, let's try and look at this from a different perspective. It's like, what are those children been through?
Yeah, I was about to go there.
And that for me shines a whole new perspective on it. And I'm like, well, do I need to go and ask them how, what they went through to find out how they're shaped? Because I don't believe at the age of 12 and 13 that people, they're a product of their environment. If they've gone through or seen it from a parent's, like, were they abused? Were they subject to it, or were they witness to it, or what was it from? Was it from uncles, was it direct family, or was it an experience that they went through? How are they, or was it something? Because I know, reading a little bit into it, we are, you know, as humans, we're always on this. There's a hierarchy, and you know, you're always trying to prove the typical alpha male, for example, is trying to probably look down to show his power and it show his attractiveness to a female, for example.
Yeah.
You're looking at trying to find being able to show that power to that female, and some of it is by intimidating lesser males.
Mm.
You know, so it's like finding someone who is not right down at the bottom of the rung, but sort of maybe, and not right at the top, because there's a good chance that's going to come back to hit
him. Challenge.
So
there.
They need to find someone that's actually within the realm that could do something, but I can keep them locked in to show my prowess.
Mm.
And is it because of that? And I found that really interesting a little while back, reading about how that sort of can come about, and then it actually starts from the physical bullying, and then gets more into the emotional control. So yes, it's deep. There's an awful lot to unpack from it.
Yeah, which is it's the manipulation, isn't it?
Mm.
Manipulating you in that process. But what led them to become the manipulator?
Exactly. And I think that's the message that I'm definitely trying to bang on about, is actually how much parents and people around children, particularly young, small children. Like I had a granddad who was a fantastic influence on me. You know, if I hadn't had that influencer, how else would I have turned out? If I hadn't turned to exercise and working hard to get myself through that, which wasn't really a choice, as in like that was ingrained in me because of the habit that I was exposed to.
Yeah, that could have been
drugs,
booze, fags, drugs, other forms of dealing with whatever it is you're processing,
or pushing
the trauma at that time, or pushing it deeper,
or pushing that abuse onto someone else.
Yeah.
And it's like, actually, where I'm very lucky to have had that. And it's like, what are we exposing our children to that when they do come up against it? Because you do need to have resilience, and resilience is something that I'm a big proponent of, because you have to be able to get through things. And it's like, can we give them the tools at an early age to be able to deal with that? And that tool doesn't mean necessarily going to do a load of fizz. It could be love.
Yeah.
You know, it could be showing them enough love and showing them enough respect to feel so self-worth that it doesn't matter the opinions of those people, or to be able to go, actually, what the strength might be to be able to vocalize how you're feeling.
Yeah, or feelings of there's love, there's safety, and really being held, so that what they are facing, they feel that they can share and communicate.
Yeah. Right?
So it isn't pushed down and held for which is an extraordinary amount of time, right? If you unpack from sitting in the room, when was that? When
February?
February, right? All the way back to
30 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long time, man, to be walking around and holding on to that stuff, right?
But also not realizing you're holding on to it.
Yeah.
Crazy thing is not knowing it's there. And that's, there's a very different mind shift in terms of going, I've got this, that's fine, that's part of me. And that's what that's where I am now. I think that's what the man weekend did, was helping me realize I'm never going to let that go. Do you know, it's always going to be part of me because it's what I went through. And it's definitely helped. Would I have got to where I got to rugby wise if I hadn't been through that? Like, if I hadn't been able to just drill myself at training, would I have reached where I got to?
Which is maybe where I went at the beginning. That David Goggins story of it, right? It's like Tom who sits here now, you know, strong Tom, and that all happening for you to sit as the man as you are today. And the more it feels you share that story, the more healing will come from it, you know. And then you're not using it then. I mean, not that you knew even.
No.
You were using that to drive it, you know. That's quite something.
Yeah, but I think I look back at the rugby side of things, and ultimately it was the rugby, it wasn't a bullying environment, but what I'd gone through triggered those emotions. So if I, you know, go back to if I had an altercation with the bullies one day, and so my mood was down, and then if they left me alone one day, my mood was up. It's very, very similar to if I got picked for the team, I'd be high as a kite. If I got left out of the team, I'd be really low because I didn't have that control emotionally. I took things very personally because I thought everything was down to me or my fault. And that's how I was always, that's what those school years did. It's like, there's something wrong with me. People don't want to sit with me because I'm the rash. Do you know, people don't want to play with me, so I'm left out of the team. And it's very much like that. So that's why I've got a bad relationship with the rugby, because I had 10 years down at the Chiefs of my emotions being controlled by someone else.
Yeah, and having those huge highs and lows of emotion.
And he had no idea. So my training would be like, well, I'm going to train my ass off so he can't drop me. And that is really bad. That's such a bad place mentally to be, to thinking I've got to do this so he can't drop me, rather than I want to train so I can be the best I can be, so I can contribute to the team.
The wee bit of it
wasn't there. But on the outside, I was perceived as a really good trainer, a good part of the team, because I trained my ass off and I wanted to win.
Yeah, fully participating is what the observation is, but underneath.
But I remember I remember doing the off-season training, and I'd be on a treadmill, and I'd go, you know, there's that David Goggins, I'd have Rob Baxter in my head going, you're either going to pick me or you're going to drop me. And I'd be like, I've got to do more sets because I'm not going to get dropped. And then sometimes he'd win and I'd be dropped, and sometimes I'd win and I'd force myself not to be dropped.
Yeah.
Crazy.
What was coming up when, say, you weren't picked? What are the emotions then?
Lack of trust.
Yeah.
Lack of loyalty. That I'd mucked up or I wasn't good enough. And actually, speaking, I saw everything from my point of view. Everything was like, you're weak or people don't want to be around you, rather than looking at it from other people's point of view, going, well, Rob had to pick a team that he thought was going to do a job that weekend or whatever, and his job was on the line. Do you know? I never saw it from other people's point of view. So you suddenly reframe it in terms of looking why I made those decisions, or what was his long-term decisions in terms of going, well, actually, I'm not playing this weekend because I've had a load of games and I need to rest. And he's looking for my long-term health, or he's looking for that longevity, or he's looking to give someone else a try.
Yeah.
But either that wasn't communicated, or I took it things the wrong way. I took things very personally. I wanted to play every week, and if I didn't, I'd be like, I failed.
And then then they're feeding into the overtrained.
Yeah, I was massive into the overtrained.
Risk of injury and risk of longevity within that. And then also going right back into that sleep deprivation conversation of where you are mentally when we're that fatigued, right?
But I used to, so that was it. I used to be like, every time I wasn't picked, I'd train harder, which was detrimental to my then training. So I was massively overtrained, and I thought more was more. And since leaving rugby, I realized there's an awful lot of different ways in different areas that I could have been so much better playing rugby if I had a much better awareness of what areas I needed to work on, and what areas I didn't, what areas I could calm down. So where my best use of time would have been meditation, nutrition, recovery. Recovery is huge. And some of this is to do with the mentality of the club. And you've got to, it's not a case of, right, we'll do less training, because you've got to train. To be up there, you've got to put the hours in. But there's different ways of doing it. And we were trained with, like, all the coaches or the PTs were ex-Marines, and they only know one way, you know, and that is more is more is more. And things have changed.
Well,
things
have changed. Beasting.
Yeah. It's just like, we're going to, let's get beasted. And I wanted, so I was like, this is amazing. This, I wanted more. I'd be like, always going to ask them for more. It's like, right, let's do another session. Let's do it. So they were, and they were led by me. You know, I was 30 years old, England international. These guys are former Royal Marines. If someone that they've never played, they've never played a decent level of rugby. If someone a player of my standing at that time saying I want to do more, they're going to do more.
Yeah.
And that's what they want to do more. So it's almost that perfect melting pot of going, right, the training, the intensity went through the roof. Wasn't getting, then starts to not get picked. Then it starts to, right, let's train more. And so you thought the way out, my whole way out has always been more. Rather than going, actually, what I needed to do was work on sleep and recovery and be fine at understanding how like selection worked and the process of seeing things from other people's view.
So fortunate it wasn't drugs and drink.
Massive.
You know, with that more kind of mindset within it, you know.
But going back, you know, you raised that point about the social media. We're in the most connected but disconnected society.
Mm.
That these young kids, they see everything on TikTok. Like I said, doing this work in schools, I spoke to one teacher a couple of weeks ago. There's a WhatsApp group set up, right? And there's 60 kids in this WhatsApp group because it's the year group, right? And one kid put on there going, thumbs up, thumbs down if you don't like this, don't like Simon or whatever his name was, right? And suddenly, bing, 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 55 thumbs down. Like that one power, that one thing, that this Simon fella, it's like, he's got no control of that. He opens up his phone in the morning, he's got, shit, I got 48, 45 people in my ear or 55 people in my ear don't like me. Just give me a thumbs down. It's like, what does that do to a 13-year-old boy?
Well, it does the same as the rash.
100%.
You know, and what that brings up. Going by what you know now, the practices you know now, the lifestyle you lead, the coaching practice that you have as well.
Mm.
And this, of course, can then overlap into perhaps parents with kids that are being bullied or the kids that are being bullied.
Mm.
Can you see if there, what would you recommend to that Tom back there out of practices that you have now? Is there anything there?
Yes, communication.
Communication.
Communication. And for a child, I think, for a child to feel that they can communicate, but ultimately you're looking at sort of Maslow's hierarchical needs.
Mm.
And you're looking at that safety first. Like, yeah. Safety is such a big thing. And for a child to feel safe, they've got to be able to communicate. And communication goes both ways. It's not like, how many times do you listen to your kids, but you're asking really for your own sake to say, to know that I've asked how my kids are, rather than listening to the tone of voice, rather than actually listening what they're saying, and then to be able to either follow up with another question or to, like, you know, when, you know, I've got an 8 and a 5-year-old, and when Heidi comes back, I'm like, sweetheart, how was your day? It's like, yeah, I'm fine. It was good, fine. It's like, I don't get anything from that. But I also know when it's, yeah, it's fine, or yeah, it's fine, and the tone.
And the energy.
And the energy.
Right? Yeah.
And actually how much you need to follow that up.
Mm.
So it's communication is a child being able to feel in a safe place. They can actually tell you how they are. But then for you, and that, for them to tell you how they are and they actually mean it, they've got to feel that you're going to listen to them. So if you ask someone the same question, they give you the answer, but you're not going to do anything with that answer over a long period of time, they're going to start giving you that, they're not going to give you the right answer that's right for them.
Well, you break the trust as well, right?
You break, because it's like someone going, are you going to do this? Yeah, I'll do it. Are you going to do this? Yeah, I'll do it. And you're never doing it. So they're like, what's the point? So they stop asking, and they stop that communication. So the communication's massive. But then I think the big underlying piece is education and people being aware of lifestyles, about how to go about things, of how, like, that myth of normal, about doing things, that you can do things that are right for you and not necessarily right for other people, that you have different systems in place that work really well for your family, but maybe not if you went to other families. And that acceptance of accepting people's knowledge, going, well, you know, if they don't know what they don't know. So it's from an educational point of view, is trying to get people to understand what's the basis of sort of healthy living or healthy lifestyle. It's that communication and education piece for me.
The communication, it just immediately, that being heard or feeling that there's someone hearing or someone holding space for that. So there's being held, there's parents holding space to hold that child to be able to feel free to communicate. It took me right into elimination communication, or it might be communication elimination, no nappies, right?
Yeah.
So we did no nappies with Tallulah and Bowman.
Yeah.
And it starts at that level because Tallulah would be in a sling. Katarina would be the first one that really built that level of intuition with Tallulah, right? Understand the feeling, the signals that would come when Tallulah needed to go to the toilet, and then she would get her to the toilet as a real baby, right? And then Tallulah would then recognize she's being heard, and the signal would get stronger. And then what would happen is the signal would get so strong because she's being heard that we'd all start to see the signals and we'd all start to understand what they were. Even at that level, you know, and what you can nurture from such a young age on that communicative level.
But it's
a word, right?
Yeah, definitely. It is. But it's all, but that comes down to self care.
Yeah.
Do you know, from that, Tallulah can self-care. She can self-manage. She feels, she knows the way forward. The way forward is not to be told how to do things. It's to do things because they work for you.
Mm.
And as a society, we've got this ass about tits.
Yeah.
Do you know, the only way, we like three quarters of the population are overweight or obese or suffering from massive mental health issues.
Mm.
And the only way out of this is not through more satins, more drugs. It's through education, about people learning from a young age how to be resilient, how to self-care and how to self-manage. And I liken it to unfortunately, I've been institutionalized from rugby. So all my analogies go back to that rugby. But what Exeter Chiefs did fantastically well when they got to the new stadium is they went out to all the different local communities and went down to Cornwall and set up these academies. And they got these academies being coached by sort of the ethos of the Exeter Chiefs coaches.
Mm.
So that they picked up those talent. Those talents were being coached in the right manner, that educational piece. So when they moved into the first team or into the first team squad, they're already far ahead of their understanding of the process. It's like a conveyor belt.
Mm.
Yeah, that's what if you look at society and we look at schools as being the academy and the Exeter Chiefs as being society, what Chiefs did was they put that educational focus by giving them the right tools to learn and grow themselves. So that when they came into society,
foresight,
but that's what we need to do as society is to put educate from the young age as possible, not just about maths and English and the vocational stuff. It's more that holistic education of people finding that self-worth and that being able to talk, being able to self-care and be able to sort the situations out themselves.
Yeah, I'm 100% aligned with that. Well, we're unschooling, right? So it's very much that. But I've spoken to this before, and imagine that we were all taught our physical, social, spiritual needs, or how to connect with our physical, social, spiritual needs, but how they are naturally, rather than, you know, food is a physical need, here's some processed food. Well, actually, here's how to feel the soil, grow, you know, forage, here's, you know, just being actually much more connected to the food systems themselves, right? Here's movement. Okay, this is how we should move, not just burpees and press-ups and sit-ups or pull-ups. It's actually, you have this incredible physicality. Here's the full expression of that and how we could nurture that throughout the day.
Yeah.
Oh, here's breath. Oh, here's teaching some breathing modalities. Mm. When you are going to go into that exam, then you can be down-regulated when you go into it, because if anxiety is coming up, and you've got cortisol brain, it's the worst position to be in an exam, right? And just, again, social needs, right? How to communicate within a community, you know, friends, family, and then help understand roles and establishing your true role within that, which really, rather than the cookie cutter model, we could then start to figure out what everyone's unique gifts and talents are and allow them to fully express them. You know, there's the show off comes in, right? Mm. We've used this language before, we have the show off, but really there's showcasing. What about educating children how to fully showcase the full expression of their unique gifts and talents? And then imagine the world we'd have, right? Imagine you're then sitting in one of these huge big circles, and each one of the people in that circle understand how to get their needs met and their human potential is met because they're a full expression of those unique gifts and talents. Imagine a world that we'd be living in, right? It would just be... compared to where it's at now, where we're like 40-something-year-old men trying to find what our potential is or our purpose is. I mean... it's ludicrous when you look at it that way, right? That we're approaching a certain age and going, oh, you know, I really don't understand what my purpose is, or I haven't reached my potential yet, and really think of what we enter the world with, the huge potential that comes in, and what the act is of coming into this world, of what that could grow into.
But I think it tends to be around sort of 35 to say 45, you get those questions because up until then, it's always been like that. So it's like, yes, through my school years to, I don't know, university into the first job, whatever. And then it's like family. So everything is like, this is what's expected of you. It's the myth of normal. Mm. And then by the time I'm 35, 40, you've got those families, you sat back and you're like, what am I feeling? Yeah. Where am I now?
And what happened?
What happened? It's like, and you have things called the midlife crisis and stuff like that. And it's not. It's just because we've probably never been in a position to look at ourselves and thought, right, what are we going to do? Because everything's been prescribed before us.
Yeah, I think I witnessed a lot of that within the circles, kind of, and in the bigger community or in the wider community now. The period of time we all went through, that 3-year period just recently, that it gave people a bit of time to go and not immersed in their perhaps the working environment of the everyday that was full of masks and things that they were going on. Yeah. It was an opportunity to actually just sit back and go, oh, wow, you know, questioning where they are and what they're doing and those what can be, again, limiting behaviors and beliefs. And questioning, like perhaps that time was a midlife crisis for many, right?
Yeah.
You know, what it exposed in that time. Going back into the schools and enabling kids to perhaps find their unique gifts and talents, talk about the project you're working on at the moment, Tom.
Yeah, I basically founded this digital startup called Plus. And it's sort of amalgamation from my rugby, my coaching, where I was trying to understand why people, I couldn't get people to change their habits. You know, I was coaching people, successful business people. I'm like, right, we need to have a look at your habits. And most people's habits were shot in terms of staying up late, on their phone, digital devices all the time, didn't understand what nutrition looked like, didn't understand that it's around us and it's a lot more accessible than we think, but we've got to make some tough decisions to do it and exercise. And it's like, the reason I couldn't change it, I say, right, let's do a journal. And the journal will be, you know, everything's too much of a hassle for people because everyone wants things now.
And they're already feeling overwhelmed.
They cannot get their head around why they can't just make this thing happen. Because everything else, you know, if they need food, they'll order it. You've got Amazon, everything is next day delivery and that's what they want from their health. And I was trying to break it down for them saying that this takes time. You know, we've got to rewire some habits, some habit forms that have been formed over a long period of your life. And so I'd be doing journalism with them and I'd be like, well, actually, are they really into this? Do they really want to do it? You know, it seemed like a bit of a hassle to fill out something for 2 minutes or 3 minutes a day. which I didn't think was a huge ask, but over time it was. Because you know, with that data, we can start to go, well, this is the areas that we're falling short on. These are the areas we need to work on. Mm. I want to know how you're feeling. I want to know how you're sleeping. I then start thinking, well, actually, what if this is so hard for people? Where's the environment? Because the whole thing with cognitive behavioral therapy and journaling, essentially, is all about self-reflection, understanding where you've been. You've got to understand where you've been yesterday, last week, last month, so that you can change what's going to happen, or you can influence what's going to happen today, after this meeting, after this podcast, after tomorrow, what's going to happen for the weekend, and what I've got coming up socially to be able to fit into the decision making around my lifestyle. And I thought, well, actually, one area where children, what's the one area in society where people are made to sit still and listen and do stuff? It's at school. So I was like, well, why don't we get journaling children from a young age in primary school? So I'm working in primary schools at the moment. Get them to journal, say how they're feeling physically, how they slept last night, how much exercise they think they did yesterday, how much fruit, how much sugar they had, and then some emotional questions of how happy they're feeling, how sad they're feeling, how angry they're feeling, if they're feeling worried, and then giving them a little area where they can type out how they're feeling, or if anything that's bothered them or anything that's upset them. And so they're doing this at the moment on like a little digital iPad that they've all got their own little Chromebooks and stuff in school. You've got 26 children in a classroom and you've got one teacher, and the classroom's so stressed at the moment. It's like that teacher's meant to know the well-being of every pupil every day. And what we've done is combine the journaling. So children journal, so be self-reflective, which comes back to that whole self-caring.
Brilliant.
So we can teach them to go, these are the signs, and give them little prompts and little bits of the resources that are right for them, rather than just go blanket, oh, it's sleep week this week, let's concentrate on sleep. It's like, well, someone might be sleeping really well this week, but someone may not have had much water this week. Let's give them the tools to be able to go and change their water intake, but to also give that teacher like a 360 view of every pupil within 30 seconds of that school, because we can present that data on a dashboard for them that goes, I need to check in with that kid. That kid's struggling. That kid's raised his hand and wants to talk to me. I know where with limited time where I can get to and make the biggest impact. And so we've developed it and we built it, and we've got sort of 10 schools doing it with over 250 kids. That's great at the moment. So it's trying to push that on, but it comes down to that whole communication.
It's so aligned with what you're expressing there, and also going right back into, well, I'd say the acorn of that is the 13-year-old boy, right?
It's
a phenomenal model. And again, that the, as you say, and then there's huge overwhelm for teachers as it is, right? But to be able to check in with each one of those kids on the daily is quite something, right? You should be very proud, man. That's an amazing project.
I am really proud of him, but it's a bit like what you've done. It's a bit like you don't never realize it because you're in it.
Mm.
You know, it takes someone, when you explain it and where you've been and when you started. I learned some basic code. I'm not a coder, and apart from LinkedIn, I'm off all social media because I find it such a bad place for me mentally. And I don't want to put my time into that. But I learned myself some basic code, and I went into my local primary school with like Google Sheets and Google Forms. I went, look, can you just try this for me? I've just built it. Can you see if it works for 40 kids? It worked. The teacher came back like 2 weeks later and go, we love it. We found out some amazing stuff about kids we had no idea for. So from a safeguarding point of view,
kids
don't want, you know, we spoke about how kids opening up and communicating. They need a safe space. And actually, the kids these days are growing up on digital devices. So let's give them what they're used to communicate, because we can then start unpacking what's in their head and start to explain, you're a bit worried about sports day. That's completely natural to feel like that. And let's go and talk about why you're worried about it. Mm. So we can alleviate that. So sports day is something they look forward to, and they can be a little bit anxious about it because it's a good thing to be anxious of, but also not going to go so far where it's having such a bad effect that they don't want to do sports day. You know, if they don't do sports day, they have bad effect at the age of 5 over sports day. What's that going to do for their exercise?
Yeah.
For the course of their life, they don't want to do it.
Yeah,
the repercussions are huge.
It flips the when I'm in my mature years, oh, I have to go for a run.
Yeah.
To I get to go for a run. Changes that narrative, doesn't it?
It is.
So much you can, I mean, that's just the beginning of where that could go, right? In that journey. Because I think of Lola and Millie, they journal and they're up in their rooms every night and it's quite something. But again, also the circles of which they're exposed to and the safe spaces they're exposed to, like the 100 Human Experience again this weekend. Lola and Minnie were either side of me in the cacao ceremony. They came to the ecstatic dance after. And again, talking of safe spaces, I don't know about you, but my observations when I was their age of adults partying usually involved huge amounts of booze, right? But here they were in a sober rave with 120 people partying hard, you know, and really getting to see the full expression of that because it was, again, a safe space, right? And their ability to communicate is within that journal, you know? It's a space where even just to, even if no one's reading that, you know, that's the important part of that, to be able to express or write down what those emotions are.
But also, it's also the understanding of it that it gives you understanding that I felt really bad today. Or look, they've got ability, so we've got a dashboard that shows them what they did yesterday and or the last week, shows them their average to go, your sleep's a little bit down from yesterday or the last week's average. Or congratulations, you've upped your sleep from over the last month. You've upped your sleep. Really good work. They can link. It's really, sleep is like the bedrock of well-being. Do you know, emotionally and physically.
Bed rock, yeah, like that. Yeah.
Love that. But it's like they can start to self-understand, going, well, if I don't get my sleep, I'm much more likely to feel more angry or more worried and have anxiety because the results show it.
Yeah.
So they go, well, actually, I need to prioritize my sleep rather than thinking I've got to go to sleep because I'm told to go to sleep. It's like, I want to go to sleep so I don't feel like that tomorrow. I give my best chance of being happier tomorrow.
Yeah, I think also what you're doing there is they're seeing social media as a tool, not social media, their device, sorry, as a tool, not so much a toy in that sense, you know? And seeing it as actually, well, if we flip it, it can be an empowering tool, right? To monitor that.
The potential is really exciting, but we've got to just get things, I could see this going into families, but I also know there's safety issues with that. You know, some children, the problems are at home. So being able to then communicate that the problems are at home and the parents seeing that is like certainly going to get them to clam up. So there are issues. I went into this with my sort of well-being hat and my lifestyle thinking, right, it's going to be great for the kids. But one of the big things is it being able to open up communications with the teachers. And I think teachers are, they're vastly under pressure and I think they're vastly underrated the job they do. They have such a big job for society, and everyone just throws everything at them expecting teachers to be counsellors, carers, parents. It's like teachers are in that profession to teach because that's what they love to do. They love to inspire young minds and young children. If we can take away the burden of them having to work out themselves how each child is, and we can get children to tell that teacher how they are and basically to highlight any issues that are going on early and be preventative and proactive rather than reactive. And that's why we call it PLUS. It's because we want children to put little positives together every day, water, sleep, because it all adds up to a massive foundation where they can thrive.
Water, sleep, movement, food, rest, human connection.
Unpacking that emotional, not being afraid to say I'm angry. Everyone goes, at the moment, people go, oh, how would you rate yourself? How's your emotional day been? You know, you've got five little sections of going, I'm really angry today. I'm really happy today. It's like, actually, take a step back, right? You may have been angry today at some point in the day. That doesn't mean you've had an angry day. Let's stop labeling things as going, well, I've had a happy day, so I've been happy the whole day. It's like, you probably haven't been happy the whole day. It's important not to go on this roller coaster of emotions. What we want to do is go on a nice steady tram, right?
Yeah.
Understand when we fluctuate a little bit and get back to that normal. Because when we're happy, medium emotionally, you know, everything fits in.
Yeah.
You've got to recognize that you've had an angry morning because something like you've been riled up by an email. But you also know when you give and you give Bobo a hug, is like the Bobo hug is like unbelievable, isn't it? So there's happiness in every part of the day.
Yeah, not
there's anger in every
not
part of the day.
Stuck. That's where the play aspect comes in as well, right? Because you can imagine yourself in a completely different position in life, no matter what age you are. If you can rehydrate that kind of play aspect of ourselves, then you can really imagine yourself in a different position. I had a moment on Sunday morning. It was the ecstatic dance the night before, and then about to walk 120 people into the lake holding hands. And yet, I talk of lack of sleep, you know, because you're holding a lot of space, and ecstatic dance finished late, and I woke up and I'm like, I'm starting this thing at 7 a.m. And as I walk through this, like a glade into where the bell tents are, the camper vans are all set up, they're all parked up. And I see six people squatting in a circle with a coffee pot and a burner going. Yeah. And I rocked up and I was kind of, I was in that, I'm grumpy right now.
Mm.
And so I appeared in the circle, squatted down with everyone else, and I had this, "How you feeling, Tony?" "Well, if I'm actually honest, I'm grumpy right now." And that, and they're trying to communicate how to fix that. And I said, no, I'm just perfectly happy leaning into my grumpiness right now. It's not going to be forever. It will just be what it is. Had a sip of coffee. We chatted for a bit. I started the circle half an hour late because I was having such a great time by the time I'd finished sharing. But equally, we need to recognize if we're grumpy or we have this going on. It's just, again, lean into what it is. But there is this, it's not forever.
But that's because society, you know? It's like, how are you? I'm fine.
Oh, I'm hungry, I'm fine, I'm tired,
But it's exactly the same. It's like, someone that says they're fine, and I do it all the time, like, "You're right, how's business?" "Yeah, fine, thanks." It's like, no, I'm pedaling like a maniac, right? But people don't want to hear it, right? And it's like, it's the same as that child not being able to communicate because they're not being listened to. So why do we say we're fine? It's because actually the person that wants to hear it doesn't want to hear actually
they're holding that energy for that, right? That response comes.
So you then change your answer to be, rather than going, "No, I'm really grumpy. I'm really knackered," right? Because they don't want to hear that. You go, "Yeah, I'm fine."
Hmm.
As a society.
Yeah, I hear a lot of the "I'm good."
Hmm.
On certain sessions, I'll start and I say, "How are you doing?" Yeah. And I get lots of "I'm good." Okay, so we're all just going to breathe for a moment. 4-6 tempo again with the breath work.
Yeah.
Mentioned this probably on every podcast so far, but 4-6 tempo breath, slow the breath. Okay, how are you doing? And then it comes. But it's also because you provided a pause where it's actually saying, "Well, I'm actually really interested."
Mm.
That's another way in. "I'm really interested to know how you're feeling." And then you also get a different response because it's not really, "How you doing?" Just because you're expecting, "I don't really have time for you. I'm just going to ask how you're doing because it's polite."
Exactly.
You know? And I feel that within that, you know, it does feel like there's time, right? There's the time within it to express that as well, you know? And it's picking up on that. So I think with what you're doing with that journaling is you are creating time and you are creating space and opportunity.
That's it.
To share that, where those moments that are going to happen within the day, "How are you?" "Yeah, I'm okay." You know, because actually they probably are going to be more okay because they've had an opportunity to express what perhaps is stuck, or they've put a lid tight on to stop them from expressing.
From the culture shift of having a time when a child comes in the settling in period, to have 2 minutes to go, "Right, I want to know how you are. I want to know how you slept, how you are. Like, I want to know your emotionally and how you are physically." For them to be able to just have that self-reflection to go, "Okay, fine. I'm starting off the day, school day, seeing how my well-being is." Because then from the rest of that day, I can enact how I was yesterday and change that if needed, or tell someone about it. And I think it's really powerful. It comes back to that whole educational piece, going from a young age, they're used to checking in on themselves. And it's that checking in with yourselves, checking with others. But I find that safe space for you to communicate how you are. from a young age is like, because we just tell kids, we speak to kids. We don't listen. And schools are trying to change it, but they're so under pressure.
Well, also they're not equipped. It's not their skill set, right? It hasn't been their skill set. And what this does, it gives them the tools to develop that skill set. You know, they're not alone in not having that skill set, because that's why we're in the position we're in, right? Imagine Tom, 13-year-old Tom, with that device in his hands. You know,
that's it. And I think that's where, you know, I was in a really bad situation where I was in this boarding school, in this really privileged boarding school, and I think that was definitely a factor where I couldn't speak out as well. I'm like, I've got everything I need, and I'm so lucky to be at this school, and it's the place where I just didn't want to be. So when I came back for holidays, I was like just out on my bike constantly. I had such good memories of school holidays, and then it's like going back to school, and I dread going back to school. I'm absolutely petrified of it. I hated it. But if I could communicate to parents, to communicate to siblings. I know my brother's still, especially my older brother, there's definitely an element of guilt. He's like a year above me, and it's like I couldn't look after my younger brother.
What, in the same boarding school?
Yeah, in the same boarding school. But he didn't really know what was going on here. Every now and again he'd come in and go, "Lads, just leave Tom alone, will you? Just leave him alone." But they didn't. I never told anyone. I just sucked it up, and that's
yes. He's never going to be aware of the degree, no, the level it was going.
No, and we've been speaking about it for the last maybe year and a half or so, me and him, and because I needed to tell him, so this is what was going on. I mean, he's like, I didn't know it was this bad, and he was sorry, but what can you do?
Yeah, I think to what you're doing now in the schools, there's definitely that's happened for you, language around all of this. And also it feels legacy, this, rather than identity wrapped up in it.
Yeah.
It's much more, this is a legacy here, Tom, you know, something that's could just keep evolving into something really quite magical that carries forward beyond their school years into their adult years, right? And that brings huge change, and that's the change we all desperately seek in this world, right? And going back to the intro on the podcast, that certainly does, you know, heal this gap between wellness as the industry and wellness as a state of being, right? You've got kids that are going to be able to access what it is to be, rather than doing and squashing down emotions that, you know, aren't serving the situation, right?
Well, just... I think my experience at school, and then obviously experience in the rugby career, is how our habits are formed at such a young age that people don't give the time, the recognition it needs. And if we can, you know, if we can get these habits formed at this early age, when they're so much more susceptible to make these really life lasting habits impressionable and ingrained, then it could have a massive effect on a lot of people, and that's what we want. That's what I want to do. Try and move from Tom the victim, and use my experience to go, well, this is a tool that I needed at school. How many other people are going through different types of trauma? Millions of children a year going through different types of trauma, and it's been able to give them, you know, can we give every one of those a better footing or more control in their life, and more tools for them to be able to self-care and self-manage their way through things.
Yeah, man. I mean, I have so much respect for you, I think, into just what you're doing, what you're approaching, also what you've been through, the resilience that you've had through that process, but to turn it round and to go on this path with it. And yeah, 100% it's relatable. And I think the more times you tell this story, it's almost the more hands that device is going to end up in.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so important, man. And I'm much love to you, brother. I think I'm very proud of you for sharing it, very proud of you for stepping up, and I guess just flipping it completely into something that, again, his legacy is going to be transformative in many young hands that will become many old hands, right? So I guess that's a good place to finish, man.
Yeah, man, that's good. Thank you, Tony.
You beautiful man. Thank you. Let's have a ching of cups, shall we?
Cheers, mate.
Thanks, brother.
Love it. Thank you very much.
As always, I hope you enjoyed today's conversation. If you feel drawn to do so, then please subscribe to the show, leave a review, and don't forget to share. Sharing is caring. It really helps me to help others. If you're drawn to immersing yourself in any of the NatLife experiences or see yourself as a NatLife coach, head to tonyriddle.com for details of how to immerse yourself in the community. You can follow my adventures on Instagram at The Natural Lifestylist. Big shout out to Simon from We Are The Clarks for producing, filming, editing. Much love.